Hello and welcome to the CGF's new sustainability podcast. My name is Louise Chester. I work in the communications team at the Consumer Goods Forum, and this is the first episode in our new series, which will take a deep dive into all things sustainability, from forced labor to plastics, deforestation, food waste, and refrigeration. Our industry has a clear responsibility to address these issues, and we hope that this podcast series will give you a little insight into the strategies of the key players working behind the scenes to tackle the challenges facing our industry and the planet. For this first episode, who better to speak to than Mike Barry, Director of Plan A and Sustainable Business at Marks & Spencer. Mike is known throughout the responsible business world for his work on the development and delivery of Marks & Spencer's Plan A, the company's consumer-focused sustainability plan. Mike has also been a dedicated co-chair of the CGF Sustainability Steering Committee since 2013 alongside Jeff Seabright from Unilever, and has recently come to the end of his term in this role. I wanted to take this opportunity to talk to Mike to capture his reflections on his time as co-chair and to get his insights on the big sustainability challenges facing the industry. So let's jump straight in, Mike. During your time as co-chair, you've worked alongside so many different industry peers on a huge range of topics. If you look back at everything that you've overseen and worked on, what are you most proud of?
I think for me, the biggest thing has been working with such exceptional people at the board level, at the steering group level, and with these companies who just want to make a difference together. None of us can actually build a sustainable future on our own. I don't care how big you are. Walmart's 25 times bigger than M&S. It can't do it on its own. M&S certainly can't. Whether it's deforestation, food waste, forced labor, plastics, we have to line up together. So getting that group of people functioning together, working together to deliver tangible outcomes, I'm really pleased to have been part of that.
So you've been involved in the CGF for the best part of 10 years now, counting the time that you were on the committee before becoming co-chair. What has been the biggest industry change in that time?
I think the key thing for me is we've shifted from a relatively small number of companies, the proverbial Unilevers, Nestle's, Danone's, the real world leaders, really focusing on this alone, to many, many other companies stepping forward in the consumer goods industry, retailers and brands, and saying, look, we can't come as we are. Economically, you know, we're doing reasonably well. Socially, environmentally, we have to find a very different accommodation with the planet and society we serve. So I think the key thing for me has been recognition that we do need to change. Is it enough? Is it fast enough? No, it's not. But it's a really good place for us to start as an industry. $3 trillion of turnover between us. We need to step forward now in the 2020s and really make a lasting difference to what we do and how we do it.
Fantastic. So in your opinion, Mike, what role has the CGF played in helping to bring about this recognition of the issues at hand and really drive forward that industry progress? And why is it important for M&S to be at the forefront of the CGF strategy?
To me, the Consumer Goods Forum is unique. What it actually does, it brings lots of different businesses together. And there's lots of places around the world you can go to convene with other like-minded businesses talk about the unsustainable world we live in. But the key word there is talk. What the CGF does is do. So it brings together businesses that operate in the same sector with huge supply chains, thousands of farms and raw material sources, factories, shops all around the world, and said, look, we've got a common interest in this, common problems. Let's step forward and do something about it. So whether it's sourcing sustainable palm oil, tackling the soy industry, starting to change how we use plastics, there is tangible change coming out of what the CGF does. Very, very few of these global organisations on working on sustainability can actually say that. Lots of good thinking being done by some other groups, but the CGF leads action.
Fantastic. So I'm assuming that it hasn't all been plain sailing. What's been the biggest challenge that you've had to face in your role as co-chair?
I think for me, it's been, again, the proverbial Brit with grey hair speaking to you here. It's been recognising there are many other cultures, many other different business models out there, many different marketplaces, just a different stage of the UK we're on this one. And we've all got to be humble. So this is about bringing together multiple different businesses that even if we call the consumer goods industry, we're still quite different. And we operate in very different marketplaces. So it's about having the humility to recognise that all those groups, all those companies have a legitimate voice, all of them have a legitimate perspective on how we should do things and at what pace. And it's been reaching out and bringing them together to work constructively together, wherever on the sustainable journey they may be, and actually saying that we've all got permission to move at the pace that we're comfortable with. We've all got permission to land things in our own subtly different ways in different marketplaces around the world. And that's been the really brilliant thing about the CGF. It's bringing that very diverse melting pot of the consumer goods industry together to find a collective endpoint we can all work towards.
So, Mike, I'd like to get your thoughts on the industry's progress. We're now a few years on from COP21 and the Paris Agreement. Are you happy with where we are as an industry?
So let me take a step back from the CGF and just look at the consumer goods industry globally at the moment. We between us sell trillions of items every year. That's what we do, whether it's clothing, whether it's food, whether it's bottled drinks, it's trillions of items. And these items have a footprint socially, environmentally, and that footprint's growing. We are heading for a world that's going to be at least 3 degrees warmer. And for anybody who's listened to this that's not sort of a climate science test, 3 degrees warming is going to have terrific impact on our society and our economy in the future. It's something we should all be scared about. We're putting 8 million tons of plastic into the world's oceans between us. That's just wrong. Biodiversity is reducing by, I think insects are reducing by 2.5% per annum all the way around the world. Soon they'll be in a position by the end of the century where there's no insects on the planet. So none of us can be satisfied with the world that we live in today. What we have all got to do is step forward, as the CGF has done, and say enough is enough. We need action. We need to keep on serving our customers today, but we need to prepare for a radically different future as well. So is the CGF doing enough today? Within the context of today's marketplace, it's doing a lot on food waste, deforestation, forced labour, plastics, lots to be proud of. Will we look back in 5 years' time and say that was just a beginning? Absolutely. And by 2030, we need to be doing exponentially more, not just individually, but collectively, not just within the CGF, but across the whole consumer market, across the globe. We have to change dramatically.
So you mentioned plastics, Mike. It's been 6 months since the Ellen MacArthur Foundation launched the new plastics economy. Can you talk a little bit about what M&S has been doing on the plastics issue over the past few years?
Of course, and like any big consumer goods industry, companies, plastic's incredibly important to us. We sell like 1.6 billion items a year that got plastic in it. It's important in terms of supply chain management as well. There's lots of reasons why we use plastic. It's good, it's cheap, it's flexible, it protects products, stops waste, it's good and convenient for many consumers. That is where we are today. We've just said 8 million tons of plastic going into the oceans today. More plastic in the ocean by 2050 than fish. That has to change. So Marks & Spencer have been doing what a lot of other good businesses have done. Firstly, it's signed up to its local UK Plastics Pact, working with good competitors here, people like Tesco, Sainsbury's, they're all part of the CGF family, and saying none of us can solve this on our own. We have to collectively step forward to change the plastic system in the UK as well as globally. Secondly, we've been simplifying. We have to use a simpler number of polymers out there so that we can all make sure that everything is closed loop, it's recovered, it's recycled. Third thing we've done is we've really reduced the amount of single-use plastic we've done. We're using tens of millions of pieces of plastic cutlery in our food halls, giving customers each year. We've now replaced them with wood, for example. Fourthly, then, we've started to help our customers bring plastics back to M&S stores that they can't recycle at home. And we've been making sure that we've got trial now in 8 stores, thin film plastics. Can we take them back and recycle them ourselves rather than relying on council systems as well? We don't want to be responsible for all plastic recycling in the UK, but we want to prove the concept and then see it rolled out more generally as well. So M&S has been right at the heart of trying to solve the plastic conundrum in the UK.
Right. So what do you think needs to happen to really solve this plastics issue on a global scale beyond M&S?
So again, M&S is a tiny, tiny fraction of the world economy, I think, but there is a lot of learning going on here. And I think businesses need to, again, simplify. We're all just using too many monomers, too many different polymers of plastic mixed together in a way that's never going to be recycled. We all need to head down and back 1, 2 or 3 plastics. It's much easier to recycle. So that's where we start. The second thing we all need to do is just use less. And we're all guilty of using plastic in a profligate way. We've all got opportunities to reduce our actual plastic footprint. Thirdly, we all need to work with our customers, making sure that they understand what we're putting on the marketplace and what they should do with it, and make it really easy for them to recycle either with us or with others. And then fourthly, we all need to step forward and help build a new plastics economy globally, working with councils, governments, recyclers, to ensure that there is a smooth movement of plastics around the economy from our use into the marketplace and back to us. We all need to be lined up and do things in the same way. And that's why the work that the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, the support the CGF is giving to it, is so very, very important. We need a big tent which we, these many different competitors in many different marketplaces can come together. So we do need a desperately a new plastics economy.
Great, thank you. So moving on to the social side of things now, what do you say to people who say that forced labour is only an issue in the developing world?
Well, let's understand, here in 2019, we're not in 1859, we're in 2019, and 45 million people around the world are still living as slaves, in effect, either in domestic servitude or in private sector supply chains. Roughly half of people held as slaves working in supply chains that supply everybody in the global marketplace. That has to change. Now, is that just happening in West African cocoa fields? A lot of it's happening there. But absolutely, we find instances in developed marketplaces like the UK where you have to work really, really hard. And the UK has brought in groundbreaking legislation with the Modern Slavery Act, demanding that we as big businesses report each year as to what we do to reduce that risk in our supply chains in the UK and more broadly overseas. That's a really important piece of legislation. I know that Australia is doing something similar, France is doing something similar. So again, the more of a legislative base we get in place, because at the heart of slavery is criminality. People fundamentally breaking the law, and we have to tackle that. And Marks & Spencer can't do that on their own. It has to do with other businesses. It has to do with the law enforcement agencies. It has to do with national governments as well. So, you know, forced labour is an absolute blot. It's a stain on society. It's certainly a huge challenge for our sector, one that collectively we need to step forward with the CGF to solve together. It's a tough one.
So from your experience, how do you establish internal buy-in around an issue such as forced labour? How do you get your CEO to agree to speak about it publicly? I think that it's a big problem that we see across the whole industry, this fear of speaking up about the topic.
So what matters enormously to me, to Steve, our chief exec, to the business as a whole, is we talk about human beings. 2 million people around the world are operating supply chains, helping Marks & Spencer deliver products to our customers. So whether it's back at a commodity level, it's at farm level, it's a factory level, logistics, people, human beings are working really hard to help us and our customers. And as soon as you see them as human beings, rather than just a big number, 2 million, you begin to respect and understand that you need to do more than you do today. So we try and make it very human. We talk about human rights. You know, this is not about business risk. We might be caught and exposed, you know, as by a problem in the Bangladeshi factory or a Kenyan farm. This is about respecting the rights of individuals. And as soon as you understand that this is a people issue and we're a people business, whether our colleagues or our customers, we care humanely about other people. And that's how you put it on the boardroom agenda.
So, Mike, I wanted to ask you, what are your hopes for the industry going forwards? Where do you hope that we will be in 10 years' time, for example?
So I've got two real hopes for the 2020s. One is that we just collectively continue to step forward as an industry and deliver today's solutions. So before we start running off and coming up with really sexy, super technology solutions for the future, let's just do the Billy Basics well. And the more businesses we can get doing that, and within the CGF's family of businesses turning over $3 trillion a year, there's an awful lot of businesses doing a lot of good stuff. There's one or two that need to do more, and we need to encourage them to join the journey as well. We then need to get the wider consumer goods industry, because we're only 10% of the global marketplace between us. We need them to step forward as well, learn from us and work with us. Just do the basics well before you walk before you run. But then that takes me deeper into the 2020s to say, fundamentally, we need new business models. We can't just make things, flog it, consumers use it and then throw it away. These trillions of items we sell every year. We have to find a way that's dramatically less carbon intensive, that is circular, so we're always bringing packaging and product back for reuse, fundamentally has well-being at the very, very heart of it, and is fundamentally making sure that inequality does not happen because of the way that we make things, we sell things, or people consume things. And let's be realistic, that's very different from what the models that any big established business has today. However, the warning for all of us, there are many small startup businesses now emerging that are challenging the orthodoxy of consumption. People can now rent clothing, they can buy meat alternatives that are fantastic, not just for the consumer, first and foremost, but good for planet and people at the same time. If we as incumbent businesses do not find a way of servicing customer need in a very different way in the future, other people will step into the marketplace and push us to one side.
So what do you think will be the next big issue that the industry will have to deal with collectively?
So look, the CGF is working on many of the big social environmental issues of today already. And there's a little bit of me says, don't rush off and try and do more things. Let's just crack deforestation, food waste, forced labour, plastics. These are enormous challenges. And for as much as I'm proud that the CGF has achieved a lot over the last decade together, it's only a beginning. So let's walk before we run. That's really important to me. Having said that, looking beyond the immediacy of, for example, deforestation associated with soy and palm oil, for example, you're going to get other raw materials coming in. You're going to have issues to do with sugar. You're going to have issues to do with cocoa. I think it's going to be really important that the CGF also finds a way of doing some process stuff. So making sure that whether it's Walmart, Tesco's, Marks Spencer, Carrefour, Ahold, when we talk about sustainable apple, we mean the same thing, and we all are not all using different approaches. I think there's an opportunity for the CGF to really look at the concept of well-being in the round. It's doing brilliant work through its well-being pillar. We're doing great work on the sustainability pillar. Actually, the two things come together in the well-being plate. Good for you in terms of your diet, good for the planet as well. So I think secondly, there's a real opportunity for the CGF to bring together some of its pillar work. The third thing is about big data to me. I've talked about trillions of items from tens of thousands of factories, farms, locations around the planet. It's a big old spreadsheet. But if you use big data, use artificial intelligence, use machine learning to actually manage that data, to see trends, spot them and deal with them, you've got a chance to operate efficiently. And then fourthly, I think there's a need to actually connect with the customer. The people are actually buying the products from us. More and more of them who are asking, but where does my product come from? What's its impact on the environment? We've got to find a really simple, compelling way of connecting them with all the great data that we're gathering and work that we're doing, so you can be proud of the product you're buying from us.
So here's a question I like to ask everybody who agrees to come on this podcast. What keeps you motivated and inspired to keep going to work every day and doing the job that you're doing?
So I'm fundamentally a glass half full kind of character. So I know that the world faces some critical social and environmental challenges. We've talked about a 3-degree world. I think that's really scary in terms of climate change. We talked about millions of tons of plastics accumulating in the oceans. We've talked a lot about loss of biodiversity. We've talked about slavery. These are all things that have to be solved. And I will, to the very second, not just that I stop work until I die, I will be trying to put that right, not just on my own, but by bringing other people together to solve it. So that motivates me. I am driven not so much by the peril of science, but the excitement of solution. And I look into the 2020s and I use the phrase, you know, Charles Dickens' opening to A Tale of Two Cities. We live in the best of times and the worst of times. We live in a time of great political, economic, social, environmental upheaval. You either seize that opportunity to reimagine capitalism and consumption in the way that services absolutely the customer, but planet and people at the same time, or you give up. And I fundamentally believe that we can do something different in the future. And I want to be at the heart of that.
So just to finish up then, Mike, I want to take advantage of speaking to someone who's clearly been so successful in their career until now. If you could offer one piece of advice to young people who want to be successful and make an impact on this world, what would it be?
Well, just two or three brief final thoughts on that. Firstly, be excited. You know, again, I've talked about all the things you can have doom and gloom about, but all these amazing new business models are starting to emerge. From Impossible Foods through to Rent the Runway to Tesla, you want to be part of that new form of capitalism in the 2020s. How do you do it? You need phenomenal EQ. It's all about encouraging people as consumers, as employees, as shareholders to do things differently. That needs people skills. Secondly, really understand how business ticks today. If you want to change how business operates, you've got to understand it. So if you're thinking about getting to a career in this space, first go off and run a shop or a category or a website first. Understand the basics of capitalism and then you can change it. Be great at building partnerships, willing and able to work with other people as the CGF exemplifies. Of course, Marks Spencer competes with Tesco's every day. That's great, the right and prop in the marketplace, but we have to collaborate as well. Have a vision for a very different future. Really have this passion that we can do things differently. You want to accept second best. And finally, be brave, because it's tough. And if people can actually see this podcast, thankfully you can't see me at the end of this line, you'd see a tired-looking fellow with too much grey hair. It's been tough, but you know what? So fulfilling. And if you want a career that really makes a difference, get into sustainability in the consumer marketplace. It's amazing.
So while we're dishing out advice then, Mike, what piece of advice would you give to the new co-chairs as they get started in their new roles?
One of the proudest things about my career in this and work with the CGF is that I've been able to hand the baton for leadership of the CGF sustainability pillar to four co-chairs, of which three are women. It's brilliant to see more diversity enter into our marketplace. We're simply not good enough at it today. Beyond that, I would hesitate to offer any advice beyond, because they're exceptional people, better than me in many ways. I would just hope that they see the opportunity not just to help drive what their business is trying to achieve on its own, and on your own it's a struggle. They see the opportunity of the CGF to do things collectively. But they also then see the opportunity to get broadened to new marketplaces. Still, the CGF, certainly on sustainability, is slightly too Anglo-Saxon. And I would like to see other marketplaces, Southeast Asia, South America, Africa, brought into this dialogue and this journey. And if we can achieve that in the next 5 years, it would be brilliant. And let's just also keep all of us who are involved with the CGF, just keep on delivering something. We can have too much chitter-chatter in the world of sustainability. We need people, these good co-chairs coming in, who will continue to drive granular change across the world.
Thank you so much, Mike. As always, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. And thank you so much for giving us your insight on all of these really important topics.
Thank you, Lise. Had a brilliant conversation. I think the CGF has been one of the highlights of my career. I remain very much part of it. And I would encourage anybody listening who can be part of the CGF's journey, get involved. It gets things done.
On behalf of my colleagues at the Consumer Goods Forum, I'd like to express our gratitude for Mike and Jeff's outstanding leadership and valuable contributions to driving positive change. If you would like to find out more about the CGF's work on sustainability, you can visit our website at www.theconsumergoodsforum.com. If you liked this episode, make sure to subscribe to the podcast for new episodes coming very shortly. Thank you for listening and see you next time.